Okay, our first panel today is on teaching and researching in special collections at McGill. I would like to introduce Christopher Lyons, head of the Osler Library of the History of Medicine, as the moderator of this panel.
Thank you. I welcome you to this session on panel on teaching and researching in special collections at McGill. Before we get started, I just want to refer to something Dr. Ver mentioned, and that is the Jonathan Hill catalog that came out yesterday with the $2.5 million Copernicus. I have it with me, and if any of you are feeling generous, we could look through this together and maybe find something you would like to donate to the library. Lots of good medical material. So please see me during the break or at lunch. I'll even buy you lunch. Thanks. The process will be in that each of our speakers will talk for 15 minutes, and then we'll take collections collectively at the end. So I will introduce our first speaker, Jillian Tom, who's a postdoctoral fellow at McGill's Rare Books and Special Collections. Her doctoral dissertation, completed at McGill School of Information Studies, provides an analytical introduction to the strengths and characteristics of McGill's Raven Klebanski collection and the relationship between the collection and its creator. Jillian has taught in McGill School of Information Studies and previously worked as a librarian at l'Université du Québec à Montréal and the Ottawa Public Library. Her talk is entitled Talking Books and the Dorothea Effect, Explorations in the Raymond Klebanski Collection.
Thanks very much. So those of you who've already had the chance to visit the exhibition at La Grande Bibliothèque will have an idea already of how lucky I was to study this collection for my doctoral work. You can get a glimpse of it behind me. Picture was taken in Klebanski's last office here at McGill, which was in fact inside the library. It has approximately 7,000 titles, and that doesn't put it among the largest of the personal collections, even among the speakers here today, but it is a magnificent collection, adding thousands of titles, especially to the humanities collections here, a great many of which are not easy to find in other libraries in Canada. And it includes hundreds of volumes from the earliest centuries of print, from the mid-15th through the 18th century. In its texts, but also in the book as artifacts, it's a valuable library of the Western tradition, and it's also a window to Klebanski's particular way of engaging with that tradition. With respect to studying the collection, totally apart from the books in themselves, the breadth of Klebanski's interests, and also just because of his biography, his development period in the Weimar period of Germany, interwar period, moving to England, working with British intelligence during the Second World War, and then subsequently after the war, coming to Montreal, but staying very active on the global scene, encouraging dialogue across ideological lines through the Cold War, etc. All of that contributes to the fact that the library opens up an enormous range of avenues for exploration. And these are far from being exhausted, if any of you are looking for a project. From ancient philosophy, German literature, mysticism, 20th century political or social history, even aspects of Quebec church book ownership. There's a lot of things to study in this collection. The number of different areas, in fact, became overwhelming for me. And the aim of my study turned finally to understanding and bringing to light the different aspects of the collection rather than fully exploring all of them. And I provided an introduction to and a basis for further, more specialized research on the collection. So I would be really happy to answer any questions you have about what I did with the collection. But what I'd like to talk about especially today are two things that emerged from the process of the study. And these were central to the way that I learned from the collection, and these touch on the questions of the symposium today. So the first has simply to do with books in groups, and that's what I'm talking about with talking books. And the second is what I'm calling the Dorothea effect. And Dorothea here is George Eliot's heroine from Middlemarch, and I'll explain that in a minute. So the first point, I think, was very nicely put by librarian and historian Matthew Battles, who wrote that together, books tell us a story that they could not tell us alone. And that, I think, is true of all libraries, but it's especially true, perhaps, of personal libraries, which are bound around these contexts that follow them throughout their lives. And one of the clearest examples, visually, with respect to the Klebanski collection, has to do with inscriptions. Now, if we look purely... Sorry, this isn't working. I'll put that down. If we look purely quantitatively at inscriptions as they're recorded in the catalog notes, one of the most striking things is simply the enormous number of them to Klebanski. Those are the ones in blue. And you can see them rising from the 1920s, an incredible rise through the mid-century, and they reach a maximum of over 100 in the 1970s alone. And so the vast majority of these, I mean, really vast majority, I think almost all of them in some of the decades, thank you, are author inscriptions, which makes them all the more interesting. And it's largely thanks to these, as well as a smaller group of Klebanski's own ownership inscriptions, that actually show us that this is a collection he was developing through his entire life. And they certainly reflect Klebanski's increasing professional stature, but they also reflect his personal networks and how those changed with his changing milieus. Most of them are known friends and acquaintances from, like, his early mentor, the polymath and philosopher Ernst Cassirer, who he worked with in Germany, and much later friends like Jean Val, the philosopher and poet. But there are others that are not mentioned in his autobiographical writings or in his archival fonds, at least that we know of until now. And just one example of this is the British writer and social activist Stephen Spender. And so together, these contribute not only to what we know of Klebanski, but more generally help us map out intellectual networks through the 20th century. It really does read like a who's who of 20th century thought, all of these. Also, and especially with respect to some of the frequent author inscribers here within the blue group, there emerges a picture of Klebanski's particular engagement with authors that cross disciplinary boundaries. They couple intellectual with artistic or literary pursuit or social engagement. And this emerged as a very strong theme. And it's entirely consistent with Klebanski's self-stated approach to learning, drawing from disparate traditions and considering especially history and literature not only as relevant, but really key to understanding philosophical texts. It's an excellent laboratory for this kind of study for us now, and it's a kind of material manifestation of Klebanski's own method. So these are just a few of the threads that emerge from looking at the collection globally, and many of the stories the collection tells were noticed through the kind of dry, but also, I think, very powerful quantitative assessment seen here. They don't give us the story, but they're tremendous pointers. And it's only through the fact that McGill Library cataloged this material at such a high and detailed level that we were able to see many of these stories. Being able to discover or read these stories is one of the great strengths of having collections, as opposed to just an accumulation of books. And there are many examples of historically interesting personal collections which have simply melted into library holdings and cannot now be recovered. The Sheila R. Bort collection of children's material is another one of these collections that we've been able to preserve as a collection and see what kind of themes emerge. That's a tremendous resource for that study. So all of this argues really strongly, I think, for maintaining the physical, but especially the virtual integrity of special collections, which makes Global Views possible. And this study was only feasible on account of that work that McGill Library did. It also argues, I think, for the investment in the kind of cataloging, like the recording of inscriptions, that makes the catalog a very powerful research tool, providing rich data sets that can be used then for a variety of purposes. So now I'd like to go to the other spectrum, rather than looking at an overview and at data, the actual encounter with the physical books. This is where I ran into what I'm calling the Dorothea effect. And those of you who remember the novel Middlemarch will probably remember this heroine and Dorothea's honeymoon in Rome. She's an English Protestant, somewhat austere, and she's suddenly confronted with the monuments and the art and the other traces of Rome's different kinds of glory. And in Eliot's words, the objects jarred her as with an electric shock. They had the effect of piercing into another universe that's connected to her own, but palpably foreign, And they disturbed her settled perceptions and provoked her to wonder about not just the objects, but about the contexts that gave rise to them. There were points of expansion for questions that she hadn't previously formulated. And so this is the key, and this is a kind of a slippery thing, and it's what I'm trying to express by the Dorothea effect. In the case of old books like these, the material aspects combine with the text, with facts about the publication, like the place and the date of publication, as well as what's called paratextual elements. It includes things like prefaces and editor's footnotes and things like that. And all of this combines to effect a similar opening into different worlds. A great deal of this, I think, can be conveyed in well-done digital representations. And probably you felt this in Dr. Ver's presentation of those spectacular items. They do provoke you to want to know something about them. But one of the most wonderful aspects of studying the Klebanski collection was the fact that I had browsing access. And that access, with its possibility of serendipitous discovery, was an incredibly powerful aspect of what I was able to had an incredibly powerful effect on my learning. I did find that it isn't always the most spectacular volumes either that draw the eye. And I'm going to show you an example, just one book that caught my eye just because of its delicacy and its smallness. And I picked it up and read it because of that. And the book is the autobiography of David Hume in a few dozen pages, followed by a letter at the end of Adam Smith, writing about Hume's last days and with a sort of a touching tribute at the end. And I don't know if you can read it from there. And there's a phrase where he says that Hume approaches as nearly to the idea of a perfectly wise and virtuous man, and perhaps the nature of human frailty will permit. And it's funny because the physical copy of this with its old type, this was published in 1777, just months after Hume died. It's got the long S, you know, that looks like an F. And so you've got Adam Smith talking about Hume, and it, for a modern reader, it's very odd because it says, approaching as nearly to the idea of a perfect wife. And you're like, what? And you have to read it a couple times. And it's a part of the historicity of the actual book itself. And so here you have two titans pressed into this little book that's, you know, as big as my hand. And the smallness, as well as the intimacy of the texts of these two now giants, reads really oddly against the backdrop of current practices and also how we think about both David Hume and Adam Smith. The physical volume printed just months after the death, the general look, the feel, even the smell, and those long S's, they all contribute to make the book a very insistent conveyor to this previous time and to the community of thinkers who so often stand isolated in our minds as canonical bubbles from the past. It forces you to attend to that other time. This all becomes more personal, of course, where there's manuscript evidence. And a nice Klebanski example is this one, which shows him madly tracing his own name all over the copy. This is Aristotle, and Aristotle's Metaphysics. And we think it's an early copy from his youth. And I don't know exactly what was happening for him at this moment, but it speaks, and it's lovely. It's very refreshing because it's extremely unlike Klebanski's habit. And it's impossible to adequately convey that in description. And just a last example is this. It's an inscription from Klebanski's good friend from his Weimar period, Friedrich Gundolf, who was a literary scholar. And here, Gundolf writes him an inscription to this book in a poem. And he it says something like, probably people here can read it better than I can, but the general effect is something that he excuses the author for his ignorance about Nicholas of Cusa because Klebanski hadn't yet been born when the book was written. And something to that effect. And it's a very nice entry point into the character of the social book world of Klebanski in his youth. And so such examples, they're endless in the collection. There are really a great number, and it's a fabulous exploration. But to sum up, throughout the study, I was forcibly struck particularly by the extent to which explorations in the library, in the midst of my readings and data analysis, consistently acted not just as a pleasant diversion or just a pleasure in the material itself, but actually as an intellectual stimulus. It renewed my interest every time in the research, It can get a little bit abstract if you're just crunching numbers and looking at graphs like we saw with the inscriptions. And this is the guts of all of that, and it really brings it home. So my message is that it's not only the opportunity to encounter once or twice historical collections, I'm speaking as a student, but a more consistent and frequent contact that can best able to engage students and other people, there are lots of other readers that aren't students, with a deep and especially a broadening interest. Whether this access is always physical or if it can be satisfied in part by creative virtual presentations is another question, and perhaps that's something we'll talk about more today. And this, like detailed cataloging, implies consequences and poses big challenges for libraries in terms of collection management, preservation, access, etc. And that always boils down to resources. It isn't easy to articulate things. I mean, I have difficulty. I came up with the Dorothea effect. It's very difficult to articulate these things in funding applications that are asking you for language of proven value and measurable impact. And I'm not sure the language itself doesn't hold within it an obstacle to our actually valorizing these collections and making greater use of them. In my and many other people's experience, nonetheless, it is very real, and it's an essential aspect of the value of these collections. I think that now, with the growing interest in book history, not only in library history or in literature, but across so many different fields, that along with the changes in technology and the changes in the models of collaborative ways of data entry and sharing of data and things, it seems like an excellent moment to think of ways to develop how we increasingly mine and learn from our special collections. So that's my thoughts on this. It was a tremendous experience. I wish it for everybody, the work I was able to do on this collection, and thank you very much.
Minutes, 58.4 seconds. Congratulations. I'll just get yours set up.
That's the idea, Gordy.
Our next speaker is Greg Bouchard, who is in his final year of his PhD in history. His dissertation is entitled The Publishing Life of David Hume. Last year, he was awarded the McGill David Hume Collection Research Grant, established by David and Mary Norton. Mr. Bouchard is also currently teaching a 400-level undergraduate history seminar on the history of the book in the British Enlightenment. His talk is entitled Researching David Hume's Publishing Life in the McGill Hume Collection.
Thank you. I was going to begin with a short history of the Hume collection, but Dr. Ver took care of that, and I crossed out that entire paragraph as he started. But I just wanted to add that while here at Faculty Club, I do plan on looking through as many drawers as possible, and actually finding out whether that particular cupboard still exists and maybe taking a photograph with it or something like that, which no one will particularly appreciate outside of this room, probably. In any case, my presentation today will focus on the ways in which the McGill-Hume collection, in particular, has served my research. And I say this collection in particular, as opposed to widely available digital reproductions of 18th century editions, or the collections in international research centers like the National Library of Scotland, or the British Library, or in modern reprints. So in a sense, this returns to a question that was asked earlier about the value of individual texts and how it is actually still useful to purchase multiple editions of a text that's available online, or for that matter, even purchasing the same edition in different forms, the multiple copies of the same exact edition, same year, same book, because sometimes there are little variations in them, and I'll give a couple of examples of that in my talk. In this respect, I am making a case not only for the value of studying texts in their original form, but also for pouring effort and resources into amassing specialized thematic collections. In the case of McGill's Hume collection, what started as an accident was followed up with passion and curiosity, and resulted in a space where scholars can study Hume with rare depth and rigor. David Hume had an exceptionally close relationship with the 18th century print marketplace. His first and most extensive philosophical work, A Treatise of Human Nature, fell stillborn from the press, to use his own term, upon its publication in three volumes between 1739 and 1740, failing to sell well and gaining ambivalent to poor reception among the learned community. Reviewers called his philosophical system too complex and esoteric, novel but shrouded in ineffective language and underdeveloped arguments. The clergy and members of the academy, including Francis Hutcheson, one of his mentors, derided the book for its skeptical and atheistic contents, so much so that Hume was denied the chair of moral philosophy at the University of Edinburgh in 1744 and the chair of logic at the University of Glasgow in 1751. So the two biggest universities in Scotland cannot claim that he taught at either of them, even though both of them actually have statues of him, which I'm sure he would find very ironic. He even faced excommunication by the Church of Scotland in 1756, but was saved by moderate members of the clergy. All of this was especially frustrating and hurtful for somebody who hoped to start nothing less than a philosophical revolution with his work, and he actually did use the term revolution. Having been locked out of the academy, how was Hume to reach the minds of his countrymen on a large scale and affect the way people thought? As he lamented to Henry Home, later Lord Kames, in February of 1739, those who are accustomed to reflect on such abstract subjects are commonly full of prejudices, and those who are unprejudiced are unacquainted with metaphysical reasonings. I am young enough to see what will come of the matter, but am apprehensive lest the chief reward I shall ever have for some time will be the pleasure of studying on such important subjects and the approbation of a few judges. With the academic market closed off to him, the best way for him to reach a large readership, and also, very importantly, sustain a career as a man of letters financially, was to sell books. He accordingly spent the remainder of his career tailoring his works to a large readership, making his philosophical system easier to understand while trying to maintain its philosophical rigor. Though he did not walk a straight path to commercial and intellectual success, his essays in History of England eventually made him a very wealthy and famous man. As he reflected in his short autobiography, which we just looked at, composed in the final year of his life, notwithstanding this variety of winds and seasons to which my writings have been exposed, they had still been making such advances that the copy money given me by the booksellers much exceeded anything formerly known in England. I was become not only independent, but opulent. Philosophers today read the treatise far more frequently and deeply than his essays or history, and in the process lose sight of Hume as he existed as a man of letters in his own time. My work in the McGill Hume collection essentially follows the process by which Hume refashioned the treatise into a succession of commercially viable works that reached far more readers than a complex metaphysical tome could ever have reasonably been expected to. This hinges upon studying the 18th century editions of his works as commodities in their original context. And so basically, I'm just going to show some examples of works from the Hume collection that have specifically helped to develop my research. And even more specifically, works from the Hume collection that are findings in the Hume collection that in one way or another would not be available digitally, and in some cases in other major collections. So what you see here is the larger three-volume work is the Treatise of Human Nature, and then the smaller two-volume work next to it, those are his essays. So you basically have the large failed book and the smaller, more successful book next to each other. Following the failure of the treatise, Hume looked to examples of writers who had sold philosophical literature to a large buying public, like Addison, Steele, Pope, Bolingbroke, and Locke. He published two volumes of essays, Moral and Political, each in a neat pocket volume for 5 shillings together, half the price of only 2 volumes of the treatise. He began the first volume with an address to readers, claiming the essays that followed were written, to quote, with a view of becoming published as weekly papers, and were intended to comprehend the designs of both the Spectators and the Craftsmen. He went on to identify himself as a new writer, severing any ties with the treatise, and proclaiming moderation in political affairs, an echo of Addison and Bolingbroke, but also a defense against those who criticized the treatise. This was, however, a book tailored to publishing customs of the moment. The Spectator and the Craftsman were originally published as loose sheets, but by 1741, they were more frequently available in multi-volume collected editions. And Hume's own essays followed this custom. This is an eight-volume in the middle, that is. This is an eight-volume edition of The Spectator, similar to the one that we know Hume had in his own library at the time. You can see that the format of his essays emulated The Spectator, as he and the vast majority of readers would have known at the time. Hume therefore created a commodity that retained the popular philosophical elements of The Spectator, but was available as a single work. And this is one thing that's lost when you look at digital collections. You can't see the actual binding of the book. You can't see how large the book is. You can't compare it to other books and get a sense of this. And so one thing you can see here is that the essays, in a lot of ways, were meant to sit on a library shelf alongside multi-volume editions of The Spectator. I was warned that this microphone was very sensitive. This partially captures his ambivalence over the polite essay genre. He saw value in communicating clearly with readers, but also felt that he had created a series of trifles, to use his own word, that were less rigorous than he would have liked. He expressed to Home his hope that the essays may prove like dung with marl and bring forward the rest of my philosophy, which is of a more durable, though of a harder and more stubborn nature. So he was happy to have some commercial success, but to some degree these essays were still dung. Accordingly, his next publication, entitled Philosophical Essays Concerning Human Understanding, was also marketed as a neat pocket volume and a collection of essays, but was in fact a connected series of texts refashioning volume one of the treatise. And as you can see from these 1748 editions of the works, they were part of a common marketing effort branding Hume as an essayist. Later, Hume retitled the Philosophical Essays An Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding and explicitly described it as a unified work. This is a copy of the Philosophical Essays, or later the Inquiry, from the McGill-Hume collection, improperly bound as Locke's Human Understanding. And actually, both of these, I should say, these are both the same work. These are both the Philosophical Essays Concerning Human Understanding. They're both the 1748 edition, but they just have two different bindings. I wonder whether this would have been described when the books were purchased, or if this was just an accident that was discovered later. Hold on a second. Since bookbinders worked separately from printers or booksellers in the 18th century, this must have been the mistake of either the bookbinder or the owner. In either case, it shows that a reader at some point mistook Hume's philosophical essays for Locke's essay concerning human understanding, a text that Hume believed perfectly straddled the line between ease of language and philosophical rigor. And if Hume could have seen the philosophical essays bound in this fashion, he may very well have felt that he got it right. Instead, from 1753 onward, he combined all of his philosophical writings, which is to say everything except his History of England, into a collection entitled Essays and Treatises on Several Subjects. And now what we have here is, on the left, that's the Treatise of Human Nature again, and then on the right is a two-volume set of essays and treatises on several subjects. There is tape covering the spine, and I'll explain why that's there in a second, but that is essays and treatises on several subjects. He came to refer to this collection simply as his works, and wished for it to embody the entirety of his philosophical writing. Most of the essays, the first inquiry, were included, and the treatise was not. From 1758 onward, he published essays and treatises in several quarto editions, returning to the larger, more expensive, and more decorative size that he had used for the treatise. This represents the culmination of his efforts to obtain philosophical stature while retaining commercial viability. His works were an important part of any library collection, and a book that was worth the price. Moreover, this book embodied his own canonization efforts. The texts he wished to retain were here. The ones he disowned were gone. And now this is opening that edition of Essays and Treatises. This is the first page of that edition. The owner, who appears to have purchased the book in 1798, transcribed Hume's advertisement from the 1777 edition of the same collection, in which Hume directed readers on which of his works constituted his philosophical canon. It says, or I won't read the whole thing, but it begins at least, most of these principles and reasonings contained in this volume were published in a work in three volumes called A Treatise of Human Nature, a work with which the author had projected before he left college, which is probably a lie because he would have been about 14 at that time, and which he wrote and published not long after. But not finding it successful, he was sensible of his error in going to the press too early, and he cast the whole system anew in the following pieces. Henceforth, the author desires that the following pieces may alone be regarded as containing his philosophical sentiments and principles. Why would the owner of this book have transcribed Hume's advertisement? It was not a key text, and by advertisement, it's another word for an address to readers. I shouldn't say this was advertising the book. It was not a key text, a lost essay, or a section of an important work. It was a short address to readers instructing them on how to read this work and treat him as a philosopher. It was so tied to his historical and to its commercial historical context that it rarely appears in modern editions of Hume's essays, and only then in an appendix of withdrawn texts. Yet a reader in 1798 felt it was crucial enough to deserve full transcription on the first page of the book. This tells us that Hume's manipulation of his philosophical canon was successful to the point of inspiring readers to follow his instructions and gather even his most ephemeral yet official texts in one place. From a commercial standpoint, he ended his life having successfully replaced the treatise with essays and treatises on several subjects as the most successful, as the most thorough expression of his philosophical system. This Hume is lost to modern readers, but he is alive in rare books and special collections at McGill. And again, much like Newton's, our edition of Newton's Optics, this is a special edition of this book that, that only we have. That is all.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Greg. Our third speaker, Michael Van Dusen, is an assistant professor with the McGill Department of English. He specializes in the study of publication and communication before print, as well as late medieval religious controversy. His recent monograph, From England to Bohemia, Heresy and Communication in the Later Middle Ages, was published with Cambridge University Press in 2012. Congratulations. And he is a forthcoming editor of a forthcoming collection, Religious Controversy in Europe, 1378-1536, Textual Transmission and Networks of Readership. His talk today is entitled Pedagogy and the Social Life of Manuscripts. Michael?
Recently, I was reading an account of a scholar who was doing some archival research, and he happened to be horribly allergic to dust and the kinds of things that get picked up and kicked up into the air when we're working with older materials and rare materials. And so what he had done is he had wrapped a scarf completely around his head so that it covered his nose and his mouth, and he was completely immune to this problem. And that's how he decided to go about his work. So he was working along, and then by contrast, it really surprised him when he looked down the table at an adjacent researcher. And this researcher had a large box of documents in front of him, and he was picking up each one individually, not looking at a single word, and sniffing them, just taking a deep, deep breath and breathing in each one, and then setting each one down and taking a few notes before moving on to the next. Now, eventually the first researcher broke down and had to ask what on earth the second researcher was doing. And as it turns out, the second gentleman was sniffing each letter to check for the scent of vinegar. These were letters, apparently, in this small archive that were from a port somewhere in South America. And at the time that they were written, he was told, evidently vinegar was sprinkled on letters to sterilize them from cholera, if there was a suspected breakout or something like that. So news of an outbreak of cholera was not likely to turn up in the text of the letters themselves because of the social implications that would result. These things would be transmitted. You know, people weren't going to visit that port anymore if they realized that there was a cholera outbreak. So they tended to be glowing reports of life. And the scent of vinegar betrayed something quite different. And this is what the scholar was looking for, and he was using other means, but he was still than reading the text, but he was still using the material documents. Now, the point that this story highlights is that texts mean in a great many ways. Texts are what might be called agents or vehicles that create and enact associations that define social groupings. This is one way of conceiving of them. And the ways in which they do this depend only in part on the words that they convey. I'm not simply referring to non-textual signification that occurs, for example, when books are lined up on picturesque shelves, although that's very interesting too, when they're deployed as furnishings more than anything else, conveying a sense of learnedness, depth, nostalgia for the past, atmosphere, the kind of things that delight the creators of the bookshelf porn blog. And lest anyone be scandalized, there is no actual pornography on this blog. It's strictly devoted to very attractive bookshelves. This is a very interesting phenomenon, too, and it's been going on in various forms for a long time, for many centuries. In any case, when I say text, I am resisting the widely accepted hierarchy of information that distinguishes the words on the page from the page, or the binding, or the layout, or the marginalia, or the water stains and dirt. Now, many scholars have recently been making valuable contributions to what's being called the social life of books, or the sociology of texts. Leah Price, for example, in her relatively recent How to Do Things with Books in Victorian Britain, which is not actually an instruction manual, examines the incredible range of social mediations that are conditioned by the presence and deployment of books and other printed matter, almost none of them involving actual reading of words on a page. Her work is part of a very enlightening trend, in my view, that can be traced most famously back to D.F. McKenzie's Bibliography and the Sociology of Texts, but obviously much further back than that. I've recently been commissioned by Cambridge to edit a volume that synthesizes and extends similar work on manuscript culture. Most of this, what I've been talking about, deals with print culture, but manuscript culture, with the hopes of encouraging more discussion of the pre-print book in book history courses and scholarship by medievalists and non-medievalists. It's also interesting to note that this spike in scholarship that attends at least as much to the materiality of texts as it does to the words on the page, has as its counterpart or contemporary the recent rise in the so-called digital humanities. Of course, even though digital humanities is difficult to define as a whole, we're currently in the process of doing that. It's a lively debate. We have seen some of the things that digital humanists can do with books and documents. I realize that digital humanists might conjure up ideas of robots and things, but this is not what I mean. Androids, yeah. The use of, they have flesh and blood, I know some, I'm friends with them. The use of digital media and methods in humanities research does not of necessity privilege words over page, which is sort of the metonym that I'm using here. There's a range of research that digital media enables that has everything to do with enhancing our human sensory and intellectual capacities to read things like palimpsests, to detect forgeries, and to do many other things besides. But the fact remains, and this is what I want to focus on here, the fact remains that the most typical and the most culturally visible applications of digital technology have to do with things like text mining and the creation of databases that allow us to do things like quantitative analysis using very large corpora of text. Text, in this case, meaning words extracted from their original material context, a context which is sometimes treated more as interference than as a source of information in its own right. Now, I want to reiterate that I'm not opposed to this trend in digital humanities research, and I'm certainly not suggesting that DH, digital humanities research, is necessarily limited to text mining or database population or anything of the sort. And indeed, can any of us, or can many of us, deny that we've benefited from precisely these kinds of projects and others? Some of the methodologies I've described are our best bet, in fact, when dealing with large numbers of manuscripts or printed texts, when we're dealing with the collation of variants and so on. Digital resources are enormously helpful when we try to show our work, for example, in editorial practice. Creating interfaces that enable users to move easily from edited version to base or variant text. And they can be helpful with collaborative editing projects as well, and I'm just naming a few. Of the possible examples, they're our best bet. What I am saying, though, is that the trends matter. The visibility, the utility, and the accessibility of certain text-oriented digital applications simultaneously habituate people to the notion of a hierarchy of information which situates the words on the page at the pinnacle and which gives the impression that eventually all research with, let's say, older materials will and in fact should be done digitally, as if the platform we use to study this material is somehow neutral or that it's of no real consequence. But I want to suggest that the platform is anything but neutral. And digital technology, as I've just defined it, which is a limited definition, must be seen as a positive supplement to other more tactile and, dare I say, more traditional approaches. And I don't say so apologetically. The same is true for models that do not necessarily rely on digital technologies in such an integrated way, but which still aim to create quantitative or schematic models for understanding book history. Here I turn to my own research on communication in a manuscript culture and before print. My work has been influenced by the impressive research of a German scholar, Uwe Neddemeyer, whose Von der Handschriften zum Gedruckten book uses quantitative methods to trace trends in book production up to and through the introduction of print in Europe and for nearly all parts of Europe. I've used data from charts like the one on the screen here to answer one primary question, and that is why, in the late 14th and 15th centuries, did scarcely any texts move from England toward England from Bohemia, which is now most of the modern-day Czech Republic, where Prague is the center of the Holy Roman Empire at the time. Why did texts not move to England from Bohemia, as far as the archival record reveals? Well, at the same time, vast numbers of texts left England and turned up in Bohemia at the same time. A graph like the one on the screen reveals that book production in Bohemia far outpaced that of the rest of Europe, or most of the rest of Europe. Bohemia is the light is driving the trend that's depicted on the light blue line that's vying with Italy to in terms of volume of texts produced in that region. And England and France are the green and purple lines sort of bottoming out there. That it gives you a perspective, some perspective here. And I use this graph. It reveals to me that the question of transmission is intimately bound up with questions of demand and the existence of a ready infrastructure for production, copying, dissemination. But there's more to the picture than quantitative assessments and models reveal. Neddermeyer's graphs show the shape of the archive and of medieval European book production in sharp detail, what Franco Moretti would call distant reading, in which texts undergo, quote, a process of deliberate reduction and abstraction, end quote, and where there are, quote, fewer elements, hence a sharper sense of their overall interconnection, end quote. At the same time, the material circumstances that have conditioned the form of extant archives, the physical realities of decay, destruction, loss, overuse, love of books, circulation, these things compel us to pay very close attention to specific acts of human intervention and textual transmission, as well as to individual texts and how their material conditions provide rich sources of information about their social deployment. And we've been hearing some examples in print culture, which is combined with manuscript culture, from the previous two speakers today. Too often, the processes and forces to which physical objects are susceptible through time leave us with little to quantify. Medievalists rarely have the luxury of constructing abstract models from the large mass of facts, the luxury that Franco Moretti has had, for example, in his work on the evolution of the novel in subsequent periods, much later periods of literary history. Neddermeyer's research provides an obvious exception. But as I've said, his models and models like that have their limitations. They cannot really represent the day-to-day practice of book production, circulation, and use, nor does Neddermeyer intend for them to do so. They do not explain how texts move and only partially help us to understand why they were produced in such quantities in particular places like Bohemia in the first place. To approach questions like these, the particular or the trace is often all we've got. In the face of such limitations, we have to extrapolate from the particular, not simply because it's exceptional in the context of the large archive, the large mass of facts, but because we have little else with which to compare the scattered traces of communication using quantitative methods, and quantitative methods can't answer the same questions anyway. We must perform highly self-conscious acts of extrapolation from scattered trees to get a sense of a forest which no longer exists, but whose contours we may nonetheless come close to discerning. In so doing, we can come to a greater understanding of the fact that the production, copying, movement, and reading of texts was, and in fact still is, inseparable from the physical mediations that condition each of these activities and others. So how is all of this implicated in my teaching here at McGill with our rare books collections? Why do I consider it to be more than just a flippant field trip when I bring my students to work directly with manuscript materials in McGill's Osler Library and Rare Books and Special Collections? I use digital resources all the time when I teach medieval literature, when I teach paleography and the history of the book, but I never do so exclusively. For one thing, students, like many of us, are deeply familiar with digital resources. We interact with them as a matter of course, and we do so many times each day. So when I show students images of an average manuscript folio like this one, they do not really get a sense of how the manuscript medium differs from the digital medium. The platform matters. The digital platform, though a valuable tool, and I think an indispensable tool, has a leveling effect, I think, in the way it reforms the experience of interacting with texts from other media, that originated with other media. Interacting with digital versions of manuscripts is not radically different from working with digital reproductions of printed texts, or even texts that were born digital, as the phrase goes now. Because of this leveling effect, it's tempting to transport our assumptions about print and digital culture to our considerations of manuscripts without first recognizing that our assumptions may have been reinforced by the digital platform we're using. But in a manuscript culture, where every copy of a manuscript is what we call unicum, a unique object, with no identical twin anywhere to be found, it's impossible. Each produced by anything but casual labor, the assumptions I outlined a moment ago become untenable. Students are habituated to interacting with images, and so images of manuscripts don't really convey crucial differences. I notice, however, an immediate change of attitude and personal engagement, however, when I bring my students to one of our rare books collections and work with them as they interact with original materials written on animal skins from the 14th and 15th centuries. Further, by relying on databases of manuscripts, which again are an excellent starting point, students at present cannot access the full range of documents in the so-called archive, particularly the humble, even off-putting traces that comprise the majority of the archive. They're simply not represented in most digital resources because databases, including and maybe especially those that enjoy plenteous funding, rarely provide representative models of typical medieval documents. This is starting to change, I'm happy to say. They tend to privilege the beautiful, the strange, and that which is set apart from the large mass of facts, as I'm calling it. And in such a way, cold economics and funding models contribute to a distorted romance of the archive. In a sense, then, I bring my students to our collections to encourage a healthy disillusionment and to implicate them in whatever small way I can in the social life of a vibrant manuscript culture. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. We have time for questions. So what I would ask is that if you have questions, to just go to one of the two microphones in the aisles here, because we're actually recording this and filming this. Please feel free. Yes, thank you. And I think our panelists could sit here, if you indicate, or if they're just general questions, go ahead and just try to speak into the microphone. Our technician's right there and can answer our questions.
There's no now. There's sound. Thank you. I would just like to ask the three panelists, how would you like to see these archives grown? Because there's been a shift in the Canadian section. We saw sort of business archives with contracts, but here it seems to be exclusively focused, and it's extremely interesting, on books and manuscripts. So I'm curious to know whether you would also like to see the kind of the documentary evidence of businesses and corporations as a reflective of the cultural life of a metropolis being continued to have that continued incorporation. And do you think that there are any areas of the archives that should be expanded, or where would you think that they should go? I see that there, I know there's a Hume specialist, I think it's a literature specialist, but also a generalist, someone who looked at everything. So I know that I have a suggestion. I would recommend that you acquire, if it hasn't already been acquired, the inheritance of a very famous African specialist who was active here in Montreal after the Second World War, but I won't use the name.
Thank you. I would say that yes, all these suggestions are fascinating. And the thing is that every one of these archives, or, you know, or fractions of archives that we use, which are not just located here at McGill. I mean, the ones I teach out of these archives, but I work at archives in Prague and England and so forth. I mean, they take so much labor just to get an inkling of what, you know, of what can be done with them. And all, there are so many worthwhile projects. This really must be a collaborative effort by people that, and over time and so forth. So this is something that, you know, and I think some sociologists and people who haven't maybe accessed, you know, corporate archives and things like this, metropolitan archives, in the past as much as they are starting to now. This, you know, it's starting to become, under the purview of so many different disciplines, this kind of activity. You know, just a general comment.
Is this on? So I have a short one here. Yes, right. there's a lot that I would love to see purchased by the library, of course. One remark, I think that an archive becomes more and more valuable the more internally related material there is added to it. So since we have the Hume collection, and we're expanding dramatically the Voltaire collection, I think it would be very valuable to keep expanding our Enlightenment holdings and our 17th, 18th century holdings. Because the more you have in one area, once you have something substantial, the more you have in one area, the more that valuable that archive becomes. The more you can just immerse yourself in that archive and, at a certain point, use it for an entire large research project. So that's just one thought, but don't want to, of course, limit acquisitions to the Enlightenment.
Thank you.
Yeah, speaking as a librarian, of course, all institutions want to collect all things. You know, that's the ideal. But like Greg was saying, the building on strength is so important in that. So one of the issues in acquiring collections is sometimes looking around to see who, you know, who has a basis for this already and who can make use of it and who's got the funds in order to process this material and do it. I mean, so many of these questions come down to space, processing, funding, and all of that is clearly tied together. And so you have to choose your directions where you go. But that said, in collections, the building up knowledge of previous institutions, whether they're commercial or public or whatever, I think that that's a very important part of heritage collections, and I think it'd be hard to find an archivist that would disagree with you on that, or a librarian. And I do know of instances where librarians, archivists, and just employees of companies have, in the absence of a current ability to actually treat these collections, have just privately organized, collected, saved, protected these things, waiting for a moment or for a place or for support for something like that. So, yeah, I mean, like Professor Van Dusen was saying, that it's really a collective effort. You know, the institutions do what they can, but it's the whole community that has to pull together and try to do our best to preserve these things.
Thank you very much. Yes, Mrs. Groen. Please do, or Sabrina will bring one to you, perhaps.
Thank you, Sabrina. I enjoyed all the panelists so very much, and my question really is for our last speaker. And you referred to, I think your phrase was, platforms make a difference, mm-hmm. very fundamentally. But we are dealing in the digital age with a very immature platform at this point. Although we're very impressed by some of the very flashy developments, we're in a very, very incunabulous stage of mm-hmm. digital culture. To what extent are some of the reservations or some of your comments likely to be modified as the digital culture matures?
Oh, thank you. That's a wonderful question, a very important one. And I think a lot of what I said would very much be modified when there's a sea change or some economic shifts, when people start to see that it is in fact valuable, that there is a demand for representation in some of these databases of documents that are not the ones that stand out, that can reveal very interesting things about the cultures which produced them and circulated them. So in that case, it's a matter of time and also change of opinion, people coming around to that kind of idea. And in fact, that is the trend in scholarship, to attend to that kind of document. And in a sense, funding models, and it's partly because this involves people that aren't necessarily, you know, specialists in these fields, are lagging behind a little bit in that respect. And they also have to consider, well, who's going to access these things? How many hits are we going to get on our website and so forth? And so there's some negotiation that has to happen. There will always be many things that digital platforms will never replace. Greg mentioned some of them in some of the printed works he was working with. Some of my own research, I try to get digital images of manuscripts that I need to then go work with. I always have to go and work with them because even the most high-definition images will leave me with questions that I still have to answer. And if I'm editing a text, for example, that's not good enough. I can't just settle for the digital image. I have to attain something as close to perfection as possible in how I'm representing the original materials, and digital, even very high quality digital images and so forth are not capable of representing that, or of helping me to look to do codicology, to study how a book is actually put together, and I'm not sure that will ever be a surmountable obstacle.
We're just slightly over time, but perhaps if there's one last question that anyone would like to pose our panelists. Mm-hmm. And if not, what I'll do is thank the three again for wonderful and stimulating presentations.
Now we'll proceed to lunch. Apparently it's just outside of this room, and we're welcoming you back as of 2 p.m. Thank you.